I go into the Del Rio bar downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, order a Tanqueray tonic with some lime because it's summertime. Look over and see my roommate's girlfriend. Gorgeous. The love of his life. The woman he tells us he's going to start a family with. And I see her making out with some guy. Some guy who is not my roommate. Then she looks at me and smiles her beautiful smile, daring me. I don't smile back because she knows full well that when I tell my roommate I saw her, he will call me a liar. He will say I'm trying to steal her away, that I really didn't see what I said I saw. I know this because it's happened before. So when she strides over, going so far as to take a sip of my drink, teasing her fingers down my neck, whispering in my ear, I'm frozen. Because now, it doesn't matter what I do or don't do. To him, the only thing that matters is what she says I did. Today on Snap Judgment, True Believer. Stories from people who trust people. My name is Glenn Washington. Can you believe they messed around and closed the Del Rio? When you're listening to Snap Judgment. Today on Snap Judgment, true believers. True stories from true people with true belief. People who believe in something. Now, we're going to kick off today's show with Rosemary, who had one goal in her life: to get to the celestial kingdom. Snap Judgment.
I grew up in kind of a rural town. The bus had to drive 25 minutes from the school to come get us. And about the third grade, as I was coming home on the bus one day, one of my classmates, he said, "Hey, aren't you a polygamist?" And I had no idea what a polygamist was. But he just kept asking, "Aren't you a polygamist?" He was saying it like it was something bad. And so I went home and I asked my mom what a polygamist was. And so she explained to me that it was where a man has more than one wife. My dad had another family, Aunt Rhoda's family, and then Dad's third wife lived right next to us. Her name was Aunt Colleen. I call Aunt Rhoda and Aunt Colleen my aunts, but they're actually just my mothers, my dad's other wives. I realized that I was different from other people. There was this word that defined me, a polygamist. Religion was the center part of our lives. We prayed three times a day, and the end goal was to reach the celestial kingdom.
Rosemary's family was part of a fundamentalist religion known as the AUB, which stands for Apostolic United Brethren, but they call themselves the Group. There's about 10,000 of them, all polygamists, living mostly in Utah, but with small communities all over the world, including a big temple in Mexico. Members of the AUB are known for being pretty upfront about their polygamous practice, and Rosemary was proud of her big family.
I was taught that families are the most important thing, first God, then family, and then country. That's how the hierarchy went as far as what was important in life. We were in the right religion.
As Rosemary grew older, she prayed all the time. In the morning, at church, just before bed, she was praying to find the right husband. And by the time she was 17...
this person comes into the group. He moves down with his family from Washington.
His name was Brady, and he was a recent convert. He was whip smart and handsome.
I'm a legs person, so I thought he had great legs. He was definitely good looking and, you know, great family. He was not related. And, you know, there's slim pickings for us women where we have to find men who are not related to us. And I talked to Brady, and he was so different. When he would speak, he would have an opinion, which was so refreshing. I remember just looking into his eyes on our way down to the Manti pageant, and I realized that this is somebody you need to take seriously as a future husband.
It turns out Rosemary wasn't the only one interested in the new, smart, handsome guy.
And I just figured, you know, there's a lot of people that like him, so it looks like I don't have a chance. My parents did not like that I was dating a convert. A lot of converts, you know, they come into the group and then they're there for a while and they get wives and then they leave. And their biggest fear with Brady was that he would get married to me and that eventually he would decide to leave and take me with him. So no, we didn't get married. He married Polly.
My name is Polly Williams.
And then he married Robin.
I'm Robin. How are you today?
This is me watching him progress in this polygamous culture. I just thought, well, maybe my time will come.
Rosemary waited. And finally, 5 years after she first met Brady, he asked her to become wife number 3. They were to be married in the AUB temple, which from the outside looks just like a regular suburban home.
Okay, so my marriage day came, and part of the process is...
I'm kneeling on one side of the altar, with Rosemary also kneeling directly across from me. And then Polly and Robin are kneeling on the other side of the altar.
Everybody's wearing white. It's all white and gold. There are mirrors on the walls that are supposed to represent eternity, because if you look one way, you can just see yourself going forever. And, you know, gold chandeliers... gold trim in white. It's supposed to represent, you know, the celestial kingdom.
The wife right before you is supposed to take your hand and put it on her husband's hand. And so Robin, being the second wife, was supposed to take my hand and put it on Brady's hand.
And I was asked, of your own free will and choice, do you give this woman to your husband? You know, and...
she hesitated. That was a really scary moment because... you know, this is her giving permission. I was wondering what was going on.
I said, I do, but it came out so quietly that no one heard me. And the whole room went completely silent, and my heart just stopped, and they asked me again. And so by that point, I was really emotional, and I forced myself to say it louder, and I did put her hand in his. Everybody else stays, you know, and mingles and, you know, congratulates and things like that. And I left right after. I didn't want questions. I just needed to be able to deal with it in my own time.
And before Brady and I left on our honeymoon, Brady says, you should go talk to Robin and just talk to her. And that was a scary thing for me to do, for me to go talk to Robin and find out what was wrong, you know, because I'm the new wife. I'm the person who is disrupting this bubble, this sweet family. And so I did. I went down and talked to her, and she gave me a hug.
I was really going through a hard time.
You know, I felt bad because you're the new person, you know, you're marrying a husband that's already a husband. And even though this was a really hard thing for her to do, she would be okay. She welcomed me. She was very sweet.
But Rosemary wouldn't be the new wife for long. 3 years later, Brady married Noni, wife number 4.
Hi, how are you? My name is Noni Williams.
And then Rhonda, wife number 5.
Oh, wait. My name is Rhonda.
I had 5 wives by the time I was 29 years old. Even for polygamous standards, that's way fast.
And altogether, they had a lot of kids.
My first is Carly.
Josh.
Madeline.
Peppy.
Mara.
And Camry.
My kids are Hannah.
Lauren.
Dane.
Tommy. And Trey.
And Trey is my 5th.
Kimberly.
Taylor.
James. And then...
Moogie or Brandon.
Paul. Was the 10th child of the family.
Rachel.
Marissa.
Buddha or Aiden.
Haley.
Addison. And Rhonda's kids are...
Eden.
Lake.
Arwen. Nicholas.
For those not counting, that is 25 children, 5 wives, and 1 husband, plus some dogs and cats. They started off all under one roof, but eventually Brady built a house for each of his 5 wives in a town at the base of the Wasatch Mountains. It's called Rocky Ridge.
It's a really, really tiny town.
We have one big grand pavement that goes up, and then all the other roads are dirt roads.
And it was founded by my grandfather, Marvin Allred. They wanted to start a community where they could live united order.
You know, it's just a quaint little polygamous town.
Brady would spend one night at a time with each of his 5 wives, rotating through the week.
I took it in stride that, you know, he would be spending the night with Polly, or if he'd be spending the night with Robin, that was their time. And it was as special to them as my time was to me, and so I should respect that. If you expect your husband to only pay attention to you, it's going to be hard for you. And if you think about what he's doing in the other bedroom, you're only painting yourself.
Rosemary was extremely generous. She moved out of her master bedroom and suite so that I could have my own little place in her home. We had so much fun. When Brady would go out of town, we would watch movies together, and we had babies that were about a little less than a year apart. And, you know, we'd wash dishes basically together. You know, we only had one hand available because we each had a baby on the other hand, and we would wash it together. Just, you know, you hold this pan while I scrub.
So the first, 10 years, maybe 8 years, life was great.
Brady was rising pretty quickly through the ranks of the AUB leadership.
I think a lot of that was tied to the amount of wives I got at a very young age. I was called to be the bishop over the United Order of Rocky Ridge, and also a 70 apostle.
Which is a group of hand-picked men, the prophet's inner circle. It was they who made decisions for their thousands of followers. Every Sunday, Brady drove an hour north to a meeting of the AUB leadership.
70s Corps meeting was kind of like the special boys club. There was, maybe 30 men in there, all the way up to the prophet of the group and his apostles, and then all of us underlings, the 70s, and they were just talking about how we needed to come down hard on how our children are being and how rebellious they're being by wearing the fashions of the day.
And a man gets up and says, "We have women in our group that are so good that they would lead their own daughters into the stoning pits for being rebellious." And I go, "Wait, what?" You know, I mean, I'm looking around the room and all these men are nodding their heads, you know, and I'm just like, holy hell. Like, what did I just hear? Couldn't imagine Polly taking Carly by the hand. You know, Carly's my 12-year-old daughter, and leading her into the stony pits because she, you know, heaven forbid, smarted off to me or went out and made out with her boyfriend or something, you know. I just couldn't imagine that. And I'm just like, wait, what? I don't own my wives. And then I realized in a very, very real way, those women had been raised to think it's okay to be owned by me. I couldn't believe that I'd raised this family to believe those same horrible things.
The problem was, if Brady revealed even just a shred of skepticism to his family, the result would be disastrous. Leaving the AUB would be like burning down his own house.
And so I just kept it to myself, and I kept studying, I kept on reading, I kept more and more embracing a progressive ideal within myself, but going through the motions of being a fundamentalist.
In secret, Brady ordered books on spirituality, feminism, philosophy.
One time, I actually took one of these banned books and I wrapped it in a brown paper bag, like a book cover, and took it to church because church was so boring and I wanted to keep reading. And I knew what I was doing was not approved by the brethren. And so I had to be careful.
But it turns out Brady was terrible at keeping secrets from his wives.
We'd be laying in bed and he would say, I wish I could tell you what I was thinking. And I'd be like, why can't you tell me what you're thinking? I want to know what you're thinking. You know, and he's like, I can't. I wanted to have those conversations with him, and I felt like I couldn't because I didn't understand. They were anti everything that I had been taught.
Here's another book about Joseph Smith and his treatment of women and how it wasn't very appropriate. And they go, wait, what are you reading? And I go, oh, it's just it's a really good history book.
He might wait for me to ask, you know, what are you reading? And ask if I could read it as well. And I would read part of them and then just put them away because they were too different, too much for me.
He had started to build a library of things that my sister calls spiritual porn. You know, Eckhart Tolle and Thich Nhat Hanh and Ken Wilber and a bunch of these other philosophers. And it was a big deal to read some of these books. If it's not church canon or written by one of the people in the group, then you know it's pretty taboo.
My wives were so devoted to fundamentalism. I knew they would leave me if I left the faith. They would probably be recommended to another man's family to be taken care of. There would be plenty of suitors that would take another woman to be a jewel in his crown. I would go from 5 wives and 25 children to a bachelor, and I would be left all alone.
I was afraid he would leave me, that he would take his favorite wife, and I thought it was Polly, and leave. That's what we had seen so many other people do. You know, when other people leave the religion, it's not like they take their whole family with them. They usually just end up with one wife because they eschew the polygamy part of it. And so I had depression because of that. I felt like I was standing on a cliff and Brady had jumped over. And what was I going to do? And so I asked him if I could read some of the things that he was reading.
Oh, we've just gotten started, Snappers. The stunning conclusion on Snap Judgment, the True Believer episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the True Believer episode. Before we left off, Rosemary's husband Brady had built quite the collection of books banned by their fundamentalist religion, the AUB. He was turning to a skeptic, leaving Rosemary to worry that any day now, Brady might take his favorite wife and leave the AUB. Snap Judgment.
I felt like I was standing on a cliff and Brady had jumped over. And what was I going to do? And so I asked him if I could read some of the things that he was reading.
In fact, without really discussing what they were doing, each of the wives started picking up a book here, thumbing through a couple pages there.
It was a challenge for me to even pick them up. You know, you're on the road to apostasy as soon as you pick up one of these books.
It was terrifying. The biggest challenge for me was when I thought about starting to choose for myself and make my own decisions rather than just being obedient, because that meant that ultimately I was responsible. And it was really exhilarating, but really scary for me in a way, because I had never felt that way in my life.
One by one, Brady started sharing his stash of spiritual porn with Polly, Robin, Rosemary, Rhonda, and then Noni.
I was furious with him for even questioning, because that would mean that I eventually would have to leave him.
Noni was only 19 when she moved away from her family in Montana in order to marry Brady.
I was going to stay true to the faith. You're going to hell and I'm not going to follow you.
It's better to stay in the religion and leave your family than to leave the religion. And so for a while, it just was kind of unclear, you know, what would happen to our family. I was worried that our family would be split up.
For me to leave the polygamist faith that I was raised in was to give up the only life I'd ever known, and every one of my siblings, my parents, my grandparents, my cousins, everyone, even my friends, they were all part of that polygamous group.
It seemed each wife was spiritually miles apart, until a Sunday meeting where the head of the AUB introduced a new edict that said AUB women shouldn't pierce their ears.
By Wednesday, we were talking about it in the laundry room. I had never pierced my ears at that point. I hadn't really even thought about it that much. But now it was something that I couldn't do because somebody decided that it was bad. I actually felt, for the first time, where I wanted to rebel.
I started researching in the scriptures to see if I could find anything that said that I couldn't pierce my ears. I even brought them to my dad because I still respected him so much and wanted to know what he thought about it. And we looked together and he said, you know, I can't find anything, sweetheart. There's nothing in there.
Me and Polly and Robin and Rhonda, we all went together and pierced our ears.
We all drove in the same car.
It was such a moment of rebellion for all of us, but
we took Noni along. She wasn't ready to get her ears pierced at the time.
I was supportive of them. I didn't feel like they were going to hell. I wasn't ready to be disobedient. I didn't feel like it would be liberating like it was for them. And maybe part of it was that I wanted to prove to myself I wasn't following them either. It was going to be my decision.
We walked in, I think it was Claire's at the mall. I had my baby Trey and Polly had her baby Camry on our hips and we're standing there and they said, oh, so are we doing the babies today? Because here we were, these 30-year-old women, you know, four of us standing there oh no, it's for us. And we all ended up going with diamond studs, but some of us chose small ones and some of us chose bigger ones.
I walked out of that store and I felt like I was floating. We made a decision and, oh, no one was controlling us. I can't even describe how good that feeling felt, not have someone, you know, telling me to do something and me just following blindly.
So after we got our ears pierced and then we all decided we were going to go out to lunch. And I think we went to Sizzler and we just did like their all-you-can-eat buffet and none of us could stop smiling. We were just in a very good place at that point.
But then came the blowback.
Rhonda's dad, Ron Allred, who is one of the apostles, and really one of the high-ranking apostles, he pulls me aside one day after church, and he says, Brady, listen, we're considering you for higher blessings. And he says, but we need you to tell your wives to take out their pierced earrings and let their ears grow in because you can't receive any more blessings as long as they have that. And they need to stop wearing so much makeup and modern clothing. And I just says, well, Ron, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to have to side with my wives. And besides, I think they look really pretty. So do what you got to do. That was a crescendo point for us.
I was afraid to go for walks, not for my safety, but because people would see me and I'd be afraid of their judgment.
Several people within the community would give the stink eye or you'd wave at them and they'd just purposely ignore you. It was like, gall, come on, seriously? I'm still a person.
I had gone to the store. As I was walking around the produce section, I was approached by one of my friends and she came up to me and she's like, hey, Rosemary, how are you doing? You know, we haven't seen you for a long time. And yeah, I haven't been around for a while. And she gave me this hug and her arms were around me. And I could just feel her hand kind of just rubbing my shoulders to try to feel for the garment collar. And I was pretty certain she was thinking, oh, my gosh, she's taken her garments off. How am I going to treat her now?
Rosemary's friend was checking to see if she was wearing her sacred garments.
It's like long underwear, and they're placed on you with an edict that you never remove them.
We had to wear them every day. They come up to your neck, and they come down to your wrists and to your ankles. They go under your clothes, and they're made of white tricot or another light fabric. But they're just supposed to remind you of the covenant you make.
Rosemary was one of the first wives to stop wearing the garments.
It was really hard to make that choice. There was a still fear in me. And honestly, I still feel it once in a while. Once you've taken those off, you have effectively removed yourself from all of the the special things that people get to do in the group. You know, go to the ordinance building and participate in prayers and even going to church.
It was definitely a family-altering decision. You know, I had a conversation with my sister one time. You know, I was telling her that, you know, some of my views. And she was saying, you know, everything's fine. You can have those views, but as long as you don't take off your garments. And I remember at the time going, oops, I already have. I knew I was out. I had made that decision.
Brady had removed his garments. Robin had removed hers. I held back and I wanted to not give up. I didn't want to give that up without being absolutely sure that I was going down the wrong path first. And so in the end, I realized that my children were now watching me. I wanted to have them have their life start on a better starting point than my life had. And so I turned my focus from pleasing my parents to looking out for my children and being a mother, the mother that I wanted to be.
After leaving the faith, the question came to what in the hell am I living this way for? If there's no reason, if there's no heaven or hell in it anymore, why?
What am I going to do? Okay, this life isn't going to take me to heaven. Do I still want to live it? And I think I went through a time where I really had to decide if my family was worth it to me.
My own conclusion was that Brady was a good husband. He was a good father. And I had good sister wives, and they had a good family. And my kids had a good social structure. And I actually had it pretty darn good with them.
Each sister wife, we talked about it a lot amongst ourselves, even, you know, when Brady wasn't there.
It's not just that I would be giving up Brady. I'd be giving up Rhonda and Robin and Polly and Noni and all the kids. And I'm emotional because, what can I say? They mean a lot to me. So we are no longer a part of the AUB, but we are still a polygamous family. And whereas we have always been in this family structure where, you know, Brady loves us, he loves the children, we have 25 wonderful kids, and we love and respect each other. And there's, you know, there's the same issues that we dealt with before, and there's still the same trials and struggles, but there's also the same joys and the wonderful times that we have together.
Choosing to stay with Brady and my sister wives, it wasn't, you know, a decision I'd made because it was the only way to heaven. It was a decision I made because just out of love.
I walked into a Noni's kitchen. She was making dinner that night for the family, and I walked in and I seriously got this strong, it was like more of a feeling, more than a voice, but a feeling of, you are home. I knew that that was where I was supposed to be.
We didn't have dishwashers for quite a while.
Where, here?
Yeah.
Oh, we raised.
We built the home, so we didn't put dishwashers in. And then for a while, we had what we called the wives fund, where everybody put extra money into this fund and let it build for 6 months. And then we all went together one day and got dishwashers.
Oh, wow.
It was a good day.
Yeah, I could imagine.
It was.
Rosemary, let me wash, because you know.
Imagine that you were born on a cruise liner and you have all these people and you're going to the same place and all you have to do is just not get off the boat. And at some point, you realize that the destination may not be where you want to go. So you make the decision together at the next stop, you're going to go on this excursion and not get back on the boat. You've left behind the people that you've known since birth, and they're taking off. They're on the cruise liner still, and you've decided that you're going to make your own way.
big thanks to Rosemary, Noni, Brady, Rhonda, Robin, and Polly. This story comes to us from Tyler Meesom, a filmmaker based in Salt Lake City, Utah. We'll have links to his documentaries and more info on the Williams family on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original score and sound design was by Renzo Gorio. That story was produced by Tyler Meesom and Adiza Egan. When Snap Judgment returns, drama. High drama snappers in the biggest den of iniquity of them all, backstage at the Children's Christian Choir. It's about to go down when Snap Judgment, the True Believer episode, continues. Stay tuned. From WNYC, you're listening to Snap Judgment, the True Believer episode. My name is Glenn Washington. Today, we're featuring amazing stories from real people searching for something to believe in. Now, a few weeks back, Snap's own Joe Rosenberg regaled Jasmine Aguilera with a tale of his youth. And now, Jasmine returns the favor. Snap Judgment.
Okay, so Jazz, last time, a few weeks ago, I told you a story. Mm-hmm. And this week, I hear tell you're going to tell me a story.
Yeah, round two of Joe and Jasmine's Fireside Chats.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. Keep crackling fire.
Exactly, yeah. So when I was 5 years old, my mom, who didn't really believe in daycare, she thought it was a waste of money, she put me in as many random after-school programs as she could find. And there was this one she found, which was a Christian choir for children at a church right down the street from my house. So she was like, this is perfect. My mom didn't have time to teach us religion, you know, because she grew up Catholic and she thought that this would be an easy way for her to outsource it to somebody
else. Yes, I say, yeah. Of course. Yeah, just that's brilliant.
So the first day, I'm 5 years old and I'm looking around at this giant church. It looks like the biggest building I've ever been in. There were rows and rows of wooden pews that pointed to this huge stage that had risers on them. And there were about 100 kids sitting on stage, and their voices were bouncing off the walls. It was so loud and intimidating. And seconds later, this woman named Janet comes out with this perfect golden bob haircut, a pastel cardigan, and huge fake shiny nails. And everyone suddenly goes quiet. She explains that her name is Janet, and she runs this choir. And then she asks everyone, who doesn't believe in Jesus Christ?
Oh, no.
And so nobody wants to raise their hand because what the hell kind of question is that? We're in a church. There's a giant cross right above us. I raised my hand and I said, well, I'm Catholic. And she said, that doesn't count. Come on down.
Whoa.
And so she brings all the kids who raised their hands down to the front of the stage. And we're sitting there in a line. She comes up to us individually and asks, do you accept Jesus Christ in your heart?
And let me pause you there.
Sure.
Because, like, when it got to your point in the line, like, what's going through your head? Like, I got it, like...
I just remember being very confused. Then when I realized that everyone at the end got candy bars, I was like, oh, this is a game changer right here. This is instant reward from Jesus. I'm down for this club.
Okay.
This choir was a after-school program that put on legitimately professional-level theater. And so everyone who wanted to be in this choir had to be perfect. If you were flat, if you didn't point your arm in the right way, if you were late, you would just get chewed out in front of everyone. It was almost like if you messed up, you were messing up in front of God. But that was just the beginning, because being in this choir meant doing exactly what Janet said to do. And that came easily to my sister, but not for me. So eventually Janet decided that I was going to be her little project because we were, first of all, one of the only people of color in this choir. And second of all, we were kind of a perfect example of helping out someone in need you know?
You were in need?
Yeah, we were in need.
Because there's like a single mother
brown
Latino
kid. Yeah.
I see, they must be in need.
Yeah, exactly. So she inserted herself in our life. She was my piano teacher. She was my swim instructor. She planned my mom's wedding.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, my mom got remarried when I was 10, and somehow she became my mom's wedding planner.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think my mom had a lot of respect for her because you should have seen the production level of these plays. This woman was amazing. She got professional carpenters to make these really elaborate sets. All of the kids had matching costumes, and we were all in sync with our hand gestures and our movements. The harmonies were complicated and intense. These are 10, 12, 14-year-old kids, and the pressure that she'd put on the kids was just astronomical. And it got to the point where, like, tons of kids would cry. I would come home saying things like, Janet is a jerk and I don't want to be around her anymore. And my mom would be like, stop complaining, Jasmine. My mom, who had a hard life when she was growing up, didn't think that that kind of trouble was that big of a deal. So she forced us to stay in it.
It's like Juilliard.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, I got my first role, my first speaking role. The play was called Red and Yellow, Black and White. And it's about these Christian kids that take a bus to the wrong side of town and discover that it's full of trash and gang members. The angels are white.
Oh.
The two do-gooding kids are yellow. The black kids had to wear black. I got the part of Maria. And I had to wear a red shirt because I represented the red kids of the world.
What are red kids as in? Like
Native American, like Native American. Or Latino, yeah. My sister didn't get the part because she would have definitely gotten the part because she didn't look Hispanic enough to play Maria.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the aspects of my character was I had to speak with an accent. So Janet was trying to instruct me on how to speak with a Hispanic accent. So she was like, just talk like your mom. I know she has an accent. I can't replicate it. I just can't. And I'd be like, I'm trying. And it ended up coming out like French sounding. All right. So, Joe, I have these tapes.
Oh, you have like what are we talking, like VHS?
Yeah, of course. VHS.
Let's pop her in.
Yeah.
Oh, hey.
So now there's a beautiful little infographic saying Music Makers, Community Choir.
Oh, Mike, I'm enjoying it. I'm just peppy.
So I'm going to fast forward.
Oh, this is like a big production.
Yeah.
There's a big audience. There are what seems to be like 100 children, all in matching white. Doing matching choreography. Oh, you guys are quite good.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed. This is quality.
All right, I'm going to fast forward now.
Here come the do-gooders, Maria.
There's me.
Off to us.
But maybe after they get over the shop, the playground does look bad.
Wait, is that supposed to be your... Oh, my God. I can't even understand what you're saying.
I can't.
Well, maybe these kids are different. Maybe they want to get to know us.
Oh, maybe they want to get to know us. Yeah, wait, because we are friends. So
maybe. I suppose say...
It was after that performance that I realized that this was not my gig. I really didn't want to keep going, and I tried to beg my mom to let me quit, but she just wasn't having it, and she convinced me to stay on for a new season. And that's when everything kind of came to a head, because the very next production was this Christmas musical called Candy Cane Lane. And so in order to drum up publicity, Janet would have us carol outside of supermarkets. So one Saturday morning, we were outside of a Lucky's, and we were all gathered there together looking identical. All of our hair was French braided. We had these big red circles painted onto our faces so we looked like dolls. And before we started, Janet laid out all the rules. There's no coughing, there's no sneezing, there's no turning your head, there's no fidgeting, there's no scratching, no movement whatsoever. So we're all standing there waiting for her to start conducting, and she lifts her hands up, and the first song is about impatiently waiting for Christmas morning to come, and the soloist starts.
Just a few more hours till the day goes away. Christmas Day will be here at last.
And out of the corner of my eye, I see this guy. I think he must have been a vet. He was in a wheelchair, and he was struggling to push himself up this ramp, and he kind of gets halfway through, falls back down, gets up again halfway through, falls back down. And so I just couldn't watch this guy struggle. But I also knew that I was going to get in a lot of trouble if I left the formation. And I just felt this need building up inside of me to help him. But every time I would get enough courage to, Janet's eyes would scan back to me and I would lose my nerve. And meanwhile, the song is still going on, you know. So I just kept watching, and all these people are coming and going, and no one is helping this guy. And I'm just like internally screaming, what is wrong with people? And my heart was telling me, this guy's in trouble, go help him. But it was almost like Janet knew what I was thinking, because she just looked at me and her eyes said, don't move. And it just feels like time is stretching super long and it takes forever to end. And this poor guy is still dragging himself up the ramp. So the next time Janet looked away, I decided, I'm making a run for it. I'm doing it. I'm gonna go help him. So she looked away, and I just bolted right over to him in the middle of the song. And he kind of looked surprised to see me, and I grabbed the handles, and I leaned up against his back, and I pushed as hard as I could up the ramp. And I felt his wheelchair kind of glide up the ramp, and when I felt the wheels go over the barrier and into the supermarket, I let go, and he kind of glided away from me. And then I turned really fast and just snapped right back into position. And immediately I saw Janet's eyes lock onto mine, burning with white-hot fury, looking at me, knowing she can't yell at me right then and there. And I know Janet is going to lay into me the second the song is over. And sure enough, after we're done singing, Janet makes a beeline straight for me with this terrifying look on her face. And then I feel this kind of touch on the side of my arm, and I turn to look, and it's the guy in the wheelchair who had gotten to me just seconds before Janet did. And he turned to me and he said, thank you for helping me up the ramp when no one else could. You're a true Christian. And right after he said that, I looked at Janet. And Janet, who's watching this conversation, waiting for it to end, just kind of goes, and I couldn't help having a smile break over my face. It was like a break in the clouds, because I knew in that moment, this was my chance to get out. Janet's just standing there, frozen like a statue, and everyone is dispersing, and I walk straight over to my mom, and I said, Mom, I can't do this anymore. I quit.
And?
And my mom let me.
Wait, did she sign you up for more stuff after this?
Oh, hell yeah. Gymnastics, ballet, tap, jazz, 3 theater groups, tennis, soccer, track, Spanish, flash programming, chess, horse vaulting.
What?
Yeah, it's like gymnastics on horses.
You know how to do this?
I'm a multifaceted woman, Joe.
Big thanks to Jasmine for sharing her story. The original score and sound design was by Leon Morimoto, and the story, it was produced by Jasmine Aguilera. Guess what? The story is never over. The snap never ends. Get full episodes from the orbiting story satellite. Subscribe right now to the Snap Podcast at snapjudgment.org. Movies of the Mind, Cinema of Sound on iTunes, on Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify. Get it your way. Well, Now, Snappers, you may know that Snap rocks the scariest Halloween story series of all time. It's called Spooked. Real-life stories from people fighting the forces that go bump in the night. Working on it right now. And some of our best stories come from listeners. So if you have a story that rises to the spooked level, let us know. Email it to us at spooked@stepjudgment.org. Now, I don't want to hear about the time you maybe saw a ghost. Boring. Looking for the spirits that haunted your family for generations. The ones you lived with. The shades that changed you. I want to hear about your fight against the supernatural powers of darkness. Or how you tracked down the mystic changeling. Maybe even the evil lurking in your great-grandmother's wooden chest. If it's all that, we'll give it the Snap Judgment treatment and broadcast it to millions of people. Let us know. Spooked@snapjudgment.org. Or call the Spooked line, 510-764-3033. That's 510-764-3033. Snap Judgment was brought to you by the greatest team that ever believed. Give it up for the good parson himself, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Pat Mancini Miller keeps the lockdown locked down. Anna Sussman believes in love. Renzo Gorio believes in dubs. Joe Rosenberg has seen the abyss. Nancy Lopez flicks a wrist. Leon Morimoto is on the team while Adiza Egan has a dream. Miss Matt, she finds dreams impractical. Tail, the genius inside the cot. Eliza Smith can't wait. Jasmine Aguilera enjoys parsnips. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you could slip on a banana peel, fall down not one, not two, but three flights of stairs, stand up at the bottom, feeling like $1 million, to the point you cancel your chiropractic appointment, and even then, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.